Sourcing Matters Podcast. This is your host, Aaron Niederhelman, sharing stories of our food. And welcome back to Sourcing Matters. This is your host, Aaron Niederhelman. Today, I'm welcomed by a good friend and co-host, Jay Villar. Hey, Jay.
Hey, Aaron. It's great to be back.
This is our first episode together since the new year.
Happy New Year.
I'm sporting almost a handlebar mustache these days. What do you think of that?
I see. That was the first thing I noticed on your face. Apparently, the 70s are back here in 2019.
You know, that's a great call. I was with my daughter, which I guess she lost. She looked at me and said, "Why do you do this to yourself?" And then another coach, I coach basketball with my son's team, and he said, "Boy, you look like that 70s dad." So I said, "All right, I'm going to own it.
Okay.
Why not? Bring it back. Styles of the 70s. Bring it back." Jay, a little bit about your background. Jay Villar is the founder and practitioner of Nourish, a bespoke consulting company with a mission to educate, teach, and train people on the benefits of using food to heal your body and optimize your health. Jay has always been at the forefront of using optimal health techniques and biohacking his nutrition to achieve remarkable results in his career. He attributes his success to principles he learned from studying health, nutrition, and business practices on increasing your energy, sharpening your mind, and being a more productive human being. Jay now spends his time teaching people how to use food to heal their body and speaks to businesses on how to optimize focus and productivity using nutritional behavioral science. Additionally, Jay has recently completed a fellowship at the Rodale Institute, and at the end of 2018, he relocated from Washington, D.C. up to our fair town of Boston, Massachusetts.
Yes.
Good stuff, Jay.
Good stuff. Thank you for that introduction, Aaron.
You're welcome. You also host your own podcast, which is a great listen to.
I do. It's called Listen to Your Mother. I started with my mom back in 2016 when I was kind of learning the ropes about health and nutrition from her at an early age. She's a holistic nurse practitioner, so all of the home remedies that you sort of hear about today, that's quite popular. She's been preaching about that for the past 30 plus years, and took me only 30 plus years to listen to it.
There you go.
And seek in.
I hear you should listen to your mother.
It's a good idea.
Jay, have you ever been over to CVS and receive one of their receipts?
I sure have.
Yeah, crazy, right?
You can use it to like measure the length of your house.
There you go. I was buying lip balm the other day and received a receipt that was nearly as tall as I, right? So I did a little digging into this because I was intrigued, and I've seen other people talking about this. Mm-hmm. And for our listeners outside of New England or California, CVS is a large chain of drugstores. It's like a Duane Reade or a Walgreens or a Rite Aid. You'll find pretty straightforward offerings in there, you know, traditional pharmacy drugstore, right? Until you get one of their legendary receipts. Now, there's pictures all over Instagram and Twitter that show these 2.5-inch wide receipts that extend well over 6 feet. Some actually folks had nearly 12 feet of receipts. Very cumbersome to deal with, and you have to ask the question, why are we doing this? It's taken a life of its own. In fact, Jimmy Kimmel asked President Obama if he could do something about it. Vox did a whole publication about this. There's even Halloween costumes of the CVS receipt. It's an interesting to read the reaction of folks that are talking about this, mostly upset environmentalists, like probably like you and I, that are asking in the digital age, why do we need a printed receipt, especially a printed receipt that's as tall as we are?
Right.
So CVS are doing this as kind of a last of their species, but it's interesting because in other areas and social pressure on their brand, associated with some reputational risk tied to keeping us healthy and focused on well-being, CVS was very progressive in the forefront of stopping the sale of tobacco in our pharmacies and protecting us against drug overdose and theft and even fighting obesity. But when it comes to our planet, our friends in Rhode Island seem to screw it up a bit here. Now, there are plenty of trees in their mind, I guess, maybe up in Maine, to have these receipts.
Yeah.
This is obviously a strategy for consumer engagement, right? That's part of a plan that leverages a digital age technology to track the interest through the activation on the paper itself. But really, who needs to print anything on paper? It's arcane and intrinsically wasteful, especially something as useless as a 6-foot receipt. CVS stitches this all together in the customized receipts, so they know your habits and your interests, and they hope, I think the objective is they hope for the impulse buy when you're walking in and out of the door.
Right.
Okay, but let's talk about a little under this. So the Americans use over 700 pounds of paper each per year. And despite 86% of us having access to paper recycling, only about half of paper is recycled. Did you know, by the way, and this was interesting in the research, the average fiber making up paper can be used and recycled 5 to 7 times.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so it's not just a single recycling stream. Additionally, 40% of municipal waste, solid waste, is paper. So we use a lot of paper every year in this country. And here's the crazy part. We don't recycle half of it, but we get up in arms over a 6-foot small receipt that maybe weighs a collective 1 pound. So after, you know, the collective is a whole year. It's interesting how the optics are in our perception of reality.
Mm.
So dealing with the overuse and waste of practices tied to paper, you know, it's not like this stuff grows in trees. I guess it does, but but the problem that we're cutting down these trees for paper, fuel, shelter, and for many other reasons around the world in our rainforests and in sensitive ecological regions at a faster rate than we did when the human population was half what it is now. So we are in a spot where we're destroying essential natural ecosystems and habitats. We're losing raw materials that can literally regenerate themselves if we got out of the way and let them do that. And we're doing it in vast numbers where we're cutting off our lifeline of actually putting the excess amount of carbon back in from the atmosphere back into the ground. Well, our guest today may be a CVS shopper. You know, he is a New Englander. He may have struggled with wrangling these 6-foot papers himself, but that's not why we have him on. He's here to discuss why thinking differently about a shrinking planet is so important and what can be done about that, especially for leaders making a difference here. We need more protection of our land and we need more protection of our natural resources. Today, we welcome a man who thinks about these things, a man who's described himself in his profile as a Mainer and an advocate.
Mm.
Today, we welcome Lucas St. Clair. Hey, Lucas, how you doing?
I'm great. How are you both doing today?
Very well.
Welcome, Lucas.
Thanks for taking the time. We really appreciate it.
You bet. Yeah, it's good to be here.
So, Lucas, let's talk a little bit about Maine. And let's talk about, start the discussion by talking about your work to establish the Katahdin Woods and Waters National Monument, which is a U.S. national monument spanning 87,563 acres of mountains and forest land in the northern Penobscot County of Maine.
Penobscot.
I knew that, Jay. It just didn't roll up the tongue.
Penobscot. Come on, Aaron.
Just off the eastern border of Maine's Baxter State Park. So, Lucas, if you could, what was your reason for starting this?
Well, I by no means can take credit for the idea. It really started back in the late 80s. Most of Maine was owned by private families, individuals, sawmills, paper mills that, protected a bunch of the landscape, kept this giant intact forest to fuel the mills. And the paper industry has spent some challenging times, despite the fact that we're using a lot of paper. It's from what you all talked about at the top of the show, but making it here in the United States and making it in the northern forest where trees grow a bit slower than other places, the industry's taken a hit. And so a lot of these large landowners recognized that their investments would be best in other places and started to sell off large swaths of this land. And depending on how you measure it, it's between 10 and 12 million acres, and several million acres of that forest started changing hands pretty quickly. And it was really safe when it was all owned by the mills. And they wanted a supply chain of raw material. And as other interests started to acquire the land, the worry that development was quickly approaching got a lot of people concerned. And one of the things that emerged from that was this idea called Restore the North Woods, and an idea of creating a 3.2 million acre national park in northern Maine. And that was a very difficult in concept, just to get the funding together to acquire that much land was really out of the question. But my mom had watched this all take place, and we were living in northern Maine at the time. And in the early 2000s, she had founded and then just sold the company Burt's Bees, the lip balm company. And so she started to use the proceeds from the sale of that company to acquire land, and so much of it was for sale. And she got about 80, almost 90,000 acres protected along the east branch of the Penobscot, and having the buffer of Baxter there made a lot of sense to kind of expand on this area of conserved land. And I didn't get involved really until the 2011, 2012, when it came time to sort out the politics. And many national parks in our country were started amongst pretty significant controversy, and this one isn't alone. There was, some folks don't want to have the federal government as a neighbor, and some people worried about traditional ways of life, and a lot of people wanted the mills to come back, and along with the sale of all this land came the closure of many mills, and a way of life got really disrupted. And so this kind of represented that disruption. It was really easy to focus on. So I started working on the project to try to bring people together, build consensus around the concept, and then work with our partners at the National Park Service and Department of Interior to make sure that they had an appetite for creating a new park unit up here in Maine.
So, Lucas, when we imagine, where we are right now in our national parks and how we got it, it's very easy to think about Teddy Roosevelt, who really championed the idea that these lands that we need to preserve is not only preserved for this generation, but for the generations that come afterwards. And to, distill the beauty that America has with these landscapes is a treasure for us, as well as treasure for our children's children. And, it started with really that administration to, preserve our resources in that form and fashion. And now we sort of take a 180 view of this in today's administration. And, how are you sort of framing that conversation that helps us look back at the days where, preservation was part of that, national conversation, where it's not just trying to diminish all of that work that's been going on?
Well, I mean, in this political environment, this particular moment that we're in, I've sort of put an asterisk as this extreme outlier from where we are normally, and where we've gone is sort of from the Teddy Roosevelt days to even the last administration. There are, as more people are on this planet, there's going to be a need for natural resources, and that's for trees and our fresh water and fresh air, and for minerals and for various different things that we make things out of. And that's a reality that we have to come to terms with a growing population. And so those interests will always be pushing back against putting land into protection where we can't harvest those natural resources. But we also are now, looking through the lens of climate change and what it means to protect our land and water and ultimately our air for the health of humans as well. I think that it's the most important problem that we have to solve as a human race. And I think protecting land is going to plays a significant role. It's one of the most important things we can do to address climate change. And so and maybe you have read as well that Wilson's last book, where his hypothesis is essentially with a population as big as it is, we have to protect half of the water and half the land on the planet. And what I think is so special and unique about national parks is that they're mandate is to not only protect and conserve the land, but do it for generations to enjoy, for generations now and generations into the future to enjoy. So it really links people to conserved areas, which I think is so important. You know, we have to be mindful of our natural environment. We have to be outside, in these places to fully appreciate them and want to protect more. And I think in our country, that great, you know, there's a lot of different ways that we've protected land through the local, you know, neighbor or town-wide land trusts to our national forests and all different fish and wildlife refuges and through the national parks. But really, it's the national parks that sort of captivate my imagination, thinking, you know, they were so set up to get people out in them and to explore and learn about these wild places.
Lucas, we had Gina McCarthy share with our listening audience the idea that if you have a different point of view of other individuals, you have to give them a strong enough and convincing argument to let them come to their own conclusions. And reading a bit of the history of putting your monument together, your family's monument together, it looks like, from my understanding, you received some accolades nationally and locally, but and as you mentioned, there was some pushback. So maybe you could give our listening audience some of the examples you were able to find to allow people within the Penobscot County, got that one right there, let them come to their own conclusions and see the value of this protected land in their backyard.
Yeah, you know, the thing that I think is most important is to meet people where they are, right? If you want to try to change someone's idea or at least give them the tools that they might need to help them change the way they're thinking about a certain thing, you have to be able to give them the information in an honest and straightforward way and show up where they are to do it. And so that really meant spending a lot of time in the region, knocking on people's doors and being very accessible and being incredibly honest. You know, there are things about the national parks that don't work really well, and not trying to hide from those. But I think in the way that we talked about Katahdin Woods and Waters and in Maine in general, you know, we're very accustomed to seeing a big forested landscape. You know, those of us who have born and raised in Maine and spent a lot of time outside, it's not uncommon. You know, I'm sitting here in my home office looking out the window at lots and lots of trees. And so that's what we know. Our context is that. And so when you say, well, this is of national significance, it should be a national park because it's so special, like Yellowstone and the Grand Canyon, people were like, whoa, well, this is not like Yellowstone and the Grand Canyon. It's just a bunch of trees. And helping people understand that this is unusual. You know, Maine is one of the most rural states in the country, and it has the largest intact forest of anywhere in the United States. And helping people realize that the place that they live and the place that they're from is incredibly special and deserves the attention of the crown jewels of our country's landscape was a really fun and exciting thing to work on. You know, in the same way that someone from Maine goes to Zion and sees these Red Rock Canyons and, wow, I've never seen anything like that. Lots of people from all around the world come to Maine and look at these trees and say, oh my gosh, I can't believe there's this vastness. And so that was really where I focused, is meeting people where they were, being very straightforward and accessible and honest, and talking about what a special place that we are so fortunate to call home.
Could you just illustrate that point then, Lucas? And like, could you describe a conversation that you had with somebody's point of view and where they ended up because of the arguments that you've made?
Sure. Well, you know, some of it is about just perception. You know, I had a lot of conversations that went something along these lines where, like, well, you know, I'm really worried that the federal government's going to come in here and they're going to start taking land by eminent domain. And they're not going to allow for hunting and for snowmobiling and for fishing and for riding ATVs. And, you know, it's really lots of rules and restrictions and bureaucracy that come along with it. And so then say, oh, well, where did you get all that information? And they say, well, you know, every time I Google why national parks are bad, all these examples come up. Yellowstone snowmobiling issues and forest fires and no hunting in a lot of parks and how that was a way of life that got changed. And so I inevitably would follow up with the question, have you ever Googled why national parks are good?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, have you changed? Just like, let's flip the script a little bit and ask a different question and see if there's information out there that say why they're good. And oftentimes I'd sit with people and actually physically get out a laptop and ask Google that question and say, look, you know, it's about how we approach these things. And if ultimately we own the land right now as a family and we want to give it away to the American people, it becomes more public. It becomes more part of all of ours than it was just ours. And we really are focused on getting there. And we want it to work for these communities. We don't want the federal government to come in here and take it by eminent domain. We don't want traditional uses to get completely taken away. But, you know, we also don't want to have snowmobiling everywhere. We don't want to have hunting everywhere. We think it's important and people should be able to do it within this national monument, but not all over the place. So if we come to this with our values and we agree with one another that our intention is to solve for yes, that we will somehow come out of this process with an agreement, and we all can agree that that's what our objectives are, then let's start having a conversation about what we want and what we don't want. And really starting on that very local level with conversations just like that, people began to change, and including myself. You know, I came to realize a lot of things about the forest products industry that I just didn't know. My parents didn't work in paper mills or work in the woods. I didn't know what it was like. And so I learned a lot, and I learned about why that is such an important issue, and it's why it's so important culturally. Saying, all right, well, if we create a monument here, we have to tell that story, right? We have to tell the story. This in Millinocket, East Millinocket, kind of the border town to the monument, it was the largest paper mill in the world, Great Northern Paper. You know, like, it's pretty remarkable. It's not there anymore, but it's still part of the history, part of the culture. And so let's make sure that when people come here, not only do they see this beautiful place with a lot of trees and rivers and, you know, this pristine environment, but they should also learn about how these mills were built and why they're here and what they supplied paper for.
Hmm.
And that's when, you know, the conversations began to change.
Sounds like quite an interesting exercise in empathy and being appreciative of your neighbors and, you know, those folks that, yes, are fighting for don't tread on me, but also those who are just looking to protect what they really love about their home state, which is evident that you share that same love. And in fact, you expressed from what you're talking to us about quite a bit of diplomacy here. And
mm-hmm.
So, Lucas, do you think that well, let's state to our audience, so last fall you ran for U.S. Congress in the Maine 2nd District. You had a closely contested race with the Democratic primary with Jared Golden, who ended up winning the seat. And as a congressman from Maine 2nd, for folks that's outside of our region, Maine 2nd is the vast majority of the state. It just doesn't have the huge population densities. So it represents much of these woods that we're speaking of in most of Maine. Do you think that your process and your practice of going through this with the Katahdin Woods and Waters developed that interest in being empathetic and diplomatic with your brethren?
Yeah, it certainly did. I spent a lot of time, you know, early on we wanted to make this a really unique national park, and we wanted to do it with a unique piece of legislation. And so I would go to Washington and I would meet with then Congressman Poliquin and our two senators and try to work through and find a bill that we all could agree on. And I just was so frustrated by Congressman Poliquin, who did absolutely nothing to help us and didn't listen to his constituents back in Maine, that he wasn't active in the process. And so I thought, you know, after the park was established, I thought, all right, you know, this guy's got to go. You know, he's not doing anything for us. And that was the initial motivation for getting in the race. And, you know, I focused a lot on the rural economy and, you know, people's way of life and quality of life in rural parts of Maine and rural parts of our country have been really turned on its head. And so I focused there. And, you know, ultimately that's probably what cost me the race, where, you know, I lost by about 3,000 votes, and those votes were almost all in Lewiston, which is the largest city in the district. So perhaps I could have focused a little more on the urban environment, but I won the four most rural counties in the district. And I really feel still that, you know, we have to have leadership that is willing to, you know, spend time in people's living rooms and hear what's actually going on in rural and urban places, and have empathy for people that are in different situations than we are, and have, you know, lean into those really tough conversations and be willing to take on issues that don't have a clear and apparent solution, and be willing to talk to people that don't agree with us. You know, it's just absolutely fundamental in order to make this country a better place. And, you know, I got into the congressional campaign for all those reasons, and the work that I do now still relates to those issues. And I really am take someone else's perspective and their realities really seriously. And I think we all could afford to do that a little bit more.
Well, now that it's a, now that the seat actually flipped and, and now
it's,
we're
very exciting.
So more in line with, you know, your views and value on the political side, do you feel as if you now have more of a friend in Congress?
Oh, without a doubt. Yeah. I mean, despite being, you know, competitors in the Democratic primary, Congressman Golden and I got along really well and shared a lot of the same ideas and beliefs, and I feel like we've got a great ally there, and I'm really looking forward to working with him as we continue our work. And, you know, I hope, and then in Maine in general, this what we saw last year, after 8 years of a very conservative ideologue governor who was incredibly disruptive to all the work that we were doing, didn't believe in climate change, and it says that he was Trump before Trump, and all that kind of that attitude and personality was very much there. You know, after 8 years of that, we voted in the first female governor in the state's history, and a Democratic held House and Senate and governor's office. And I have to believe that this is foreshadowing where our nation is going to go. That, you know, we flirted with a different style of politics and a different style of governing, and we saw the result was harmful. And, you know, it takes a lot of intelligence and compassion and thoughtfulness and time and energy and commitment to making places better to be able to make our democracy run well. And I think our democracy certainly is going to live through this particular moment in time. It might be some bruises after it all, but I'm convinced that we can recognize the need for thoughtful and compassionate leadership.
It seems that that might be the only true and accurate thing that LePage said, was that he was Trump before Trump. That is actually pretty true. So there you go. And it is nice to see him out of there and other demagogues like himself. So very good. And I wanted to ask, just to close this out on the political side, whether it's for the Maine second or for other races, will we see you on future ballots?
Perhaps. Yeah. At some point, the opportunity to serve the people of Maine is something that I would be incredibly fortunate to be able to do. But there are a lot of different ways to do that. And whether it's serving in elected office or otherwise. I hope to be able to continue to do that and, you know, be an advocate and voice for rural Maine and for conservation and to protect the incredible natural resources here and hope to turn more people onto it. I mean, despite being quite rural and I like the rural characteristics of Maine, we could afford to have some more people here too. So getting some people excited about coming to Maine and living here is certainly a priority of mine as well.
It's more than vacation land.
Oh,
that's right. That's
I hear
right.
Portland's lovely. Has a good restaurant scene.
That's very true.
it's a great town.
Yeah, Bon Appetit's top restaurants city in the country, actually, I think, this year.
That's
pretty,
right.
Pretty impressive.
A lot of lakes.
A lot of good things in Maine. Lucas, let me ask this, if we could, because I'm intrigued. You had mentioned your mother was Roxanne Quimby, and your folks had founded Burt's Bees. Your involvement, your engagement, and just the general intrinsic aspects of that brand in connection with natural order and responsibility, could you share with us a bit of maybe how your upbringing fed onto this interest of advocacy, service, and consciousness that you're implementing through your career now?
Yeah, I was born in a cabin my parents built about a half mile back in the woods in northern Maine. We didn't have running water or electricity. And, you know, I saw television for the first time when I watched the Mets-Red Sox World Series at a neighbor's house. Still don't like television.
I was going to say, turn that thing off then, right?
Yeah, totally right. And, you know, so I grew up with, you know, everything that came into our house served a function. And we would see everything as, you know, it was very much in equilibrium. And living that close to the land and is a very eye-opening experience. And my mother ran Burt's Bees very much that same way. You know, she started it on a wood stove, making polish for wood stoves and for boots and, you know, using bear grease from an old farmer's almanac recipe to make, you know, leather boots last longer. It was very much a pragmatic solution to, you know, she needed something. And then she's like, you know what, you probably sell them at the local craft fair. And so the company was so extremely efficient. They always did every effort to minimize waste to make sure that they made a product that no one wanted to waste. And they, that was just built into our family's DNA. And you know, my mother is the first person born on her side of the family in the United States. And, you know, as sort of immigrant, as a family of immigrants, I think there's sort of this mentality that you never know what's going to happen. And so you're very resourceful and hang on to things. And I think that all played into our upbringing, but it definitely had an impact. And I think why, you know, I feel incredibly fortunate to have the opportunity to give back in the ways that I have and, you know, to have this perspective and then really to be blessed with a knowledge and awareness of what the outdoors can do. You know, I know that most people feel best when they spend time in nature, and not everyone gets to realize that's the case. And some people come to that much later in life. And when I graduated from high school, my parents said, you know what, you should go hike the Appalachian Trail. You know, go spend 6 months backpacking. And that's exactly what I did. You know, I carried everything that I needed on my back. And that, you know, what an incredible thing to be able to have parents that were comfortable with that and promoting that type of activity and then getting to know it, you know, at 17, 18 years old, knowing, you know, what a clear mind can, how clear your mind can be when you spend time outdoors. And, you know, now being a father of two young kids, that's what I can pass on to them. And just the knowledge and awareness of the great things that happen to you when you're outside.
So Lucas, I have a question. So you grew up in a environment that didn't, you know, value, you know, the things that people see on TV. Right. And you were able to really sort of see the world as far as what, you know, strong family and community and being, you know, tied to the resources of the land can really provide for you. And then you know, your family ends up building this, you know, national, someone calls it like iconic brand that's pretty much a household name at this point. And, you know, so now you're sort of afforded these, you know, luxuries and these, you know, resources and opportunities that that are just literally at your fingertips. So how do you, you know, stay, you know, grounded in the life lessons that you've learned? And then how are you sort of instilling that in your children as well?
Well, it, you know, kids do a great job of grounding anyone. You know, they, and I think a lot now about what, you know, ways in which I can make sure that my kids are grounded and present. And I think it's a difficult thing, certainly, but both my parents still, you know, they live very simple lifestyles, and they're not extravagant by any stretch of the imagination. And, you know, we value time together as a family over possessions and activity. You know, when we get together, we you know, our vacations are spent doing things outside. And you know, I saw my sister yesterday and brought our kids, and we went out for a walk. She lives in Portland, and we went on the Portland trails and walked around in the ice and snow. And that, you know, that has always been the way we connect, and passing that on to my kids is super important. And it takes discipline, you know, certainly, and hard work. But I think it's really important to make sure that we can pass on, you know, those values to our next generation. And, you know, being a member of the community, I heard you say in the opening that you coach your child's basketball team. Let's do the same. I've got my daughter's basketball practice tonight, you know, and showing up in the gym and making sure they realize that I'm there for them. And, you know, all that is so important. Mm.
It's, I'll say, by having a handlebar mustache, when I yell at them on the court, they really hear it now.
Oh, yeah.
They run twice as hard.
Well, it's like echoing now.
It is,
right?
Yeah. It just kind of like resonates in there.
Right.
Lucas, for last question, I wanted to take a bit of what Jay was speaking of there and ask you. And when I saw your story and learned more about it, I was intrigued, because in dealing with individuals of means or family offices, the question and the discussion of succession always comes up, and succession is many layers deep. I looked at what you've created as a very interesting model. It appears we live in a world we're not going to have more national parks. The days of Teddy Roosevelt, I think, will be challenged to come up with eminent domain and having resources to get that. But if you help instigate a model where individuals of means can give these large swaths of lands and convert them into gifts to our country, to our regions, to our communities, or even our states, boy, that seems like a pretty unique model to implement. Have you seen anything like that from other individuals, other family offices, other groups that have asked you questions to learn more about the monument in the Katahdin Woods?
Yes. You know, and that's, you know, that's something to me that is so exciting, is that I can use this as a kind of bully pulpit to talk about why other people should be doing it as well. You know, if we don't have an income tax rate that was, you know, in the 90% like it was during the New Deal when we built America's middle class, then we're going to have to rely on philanthropy and people willing just to give their money away to do these types of things. And the day that President Obama signed the proclamation that created Katahdin Woods and Waters, the headline on the New York Times was, the last, what could possibly be the last landscape size national park in the East was created today. Hmm. And I looked at that and thought, oh, that's a challenge, right? Like, let's make sure it's not the last. And, you know, there's Ansorg Wies wrote an op-ed in the New York Times saying he's giving billions away to land protection. Shortly after the creation of the monument up here in Maine, I was invited to go down to Argentina with a handful of philanthropists and outdoor enthusiasts, including Ivan Chouinard from Patagonia. And we met with the incoming president of Argentina to talk about national parks and how they're good for the economy and good for the planet and good for your quality of life and good for the people that live in your country. And so there has been an opportunity to use what our family has done to talk about it more broadly and say, look, and within the national parks, like, there's a 100-year-old legacy of philanthropy and the creation of parks. Acadia was created by a gift from the Rockefeller family, and St. John down in the Virgin Islands, and the Tetons, and the Great Smoky Mountains, and on and on and on. It's definitely been a tradition in the national park of philanthropy. We just have to make sure we don't lose sight of that now, and you know, we can get caught up in the backlog of maintenance and the diminishing baselines of quality of our parks, and you know, that the fact that when there's a government shutdown, they get beaten up, and so maybe we shouldn't have them. Like, we can't get stuck in that conversation, and we have to talk about how we're going to protect more land and more water, and why it's good for our economy, and why it's good for our people. And if you have means, that you should be join in this effort. And you know, they're not going to make any more of it. Land is the most important thing that you can buy. There's a finite amount on the earth, and it's absolutely tied to our survival. So why not start there?
Fantastic stuff, Lucas. I can't thank you enough for partaking in today's conversation. Where could our listening audience learn more about the Katahdin Woods and Waters National Monument, and also your, I think it's Elliottsville Plantation, Inc.?
Yes, exactly. So the National Park Service's website is up and running now.
We're off shutdown. There you go.
Yeah, so you can go to, I think it's Katahdin Woods and Waters, nationalparkservice.gov. I'm sure we have a quick Google search and you can find the NPS site. I'd strongly encourage people to become members and look at the Friends of Katahdin Woods and Waters. They're doing great work to support the monument and to build infrastructure and do programs and work with local community schools, and it's just a wonderful organization. They've got maps and a bunch of stuff on their website. And we're actually going through a website overhaul with the foundation. So there's not much online about us, but we're really focusing on supporting the Friends group and helping the monument get off its feet in the first few years.
Jay, final thoughts?
Well, Lucas, I mean, for someone that has completely transformed themselves in multiple phases and transitions in their life, you know, from growing up homesteading to hiking the Alpine Trail to being a fly fisherman tour guide to being a chef to running for to being a restaurateur to running for Congress, and now to like managing this like pretty significant legacy project. I know that, you know, what you're doing here and then whatever next evolution comes after this is going to be pretty good. So thanks for being one of the good guys out there.
Well, thanks for saying that. It's been super fun to have this conversation, and when you say it like that, it makes me think I've got to come up with a really great project next.
Totally. We set that bar pretty high there, right?
Yeah. Like, hey, I'm just following the trail, you know, and just reading off what I'm learning about. It's up to you.
Right.
You can't take
my
weekends.
My mom actually said that the other day. She was like, well, maybe you just peaked too early. You know, you're 40, and I don't know what you're going to do next.
Put on a nice beer gut and sit around the living room. Get that TV. You can now get like 90-inch TVs.
Oh,
you can
no.
sit there, kick his feet up, and there you go.
40 is the new 20.
There you go. Age is a mindset.
That's right.
Well, I'll just close by saying, I mean, Jay, that was great, and I agree with what you said with Lucas. And Lucas, you should receive all those accolades. It's very exciting, and I think the more that we can help spread the word of these type of initiatives is quite, I'm enthusiastic by what that represents for a better world for my kids, for all of our kids. Do you know my 6-foot receipt from CVS was for a Burt's Bees lip balm?
No way.
There you go.
Nice.
Leave it all together.
Okay.
Leave it all together. It's all stitched together.
See, now we need to keep it.
There it goes. Done.
Well, I hope you use it.
That's right. That's right. I'll take a photo of it. It'll be my next Halloween costume. Well, Lucas St. Clair, thank you so much for partaking in today's conversation. I learned a great deal. Jay, I think you learned a great deal.
I learned a great deal. Always.
And I know our audience well as well. So thanks for taking the time.
No, it was a real pleasure. Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.